Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have two published novels. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. My latest is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. My previous novel is titled Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. Both of those novels are listed in the episode notes. Now, on with our program. In the spotlight is Kat Rosenfield.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm Kat Rosenfield. I am a culture writer, a columnist at Unheard Magazine, and the author of 5 books, including most recently, You Must Remember This, which was released just this week on January 10th.
Kat Rosenfield, namaste. You are a yoga instructor, after all. You just did some yoga this morning. I understand. I've been part of the practice for 40 years, and I can tell our listeners that if we were on video, which we don't do, but if we were, we'd be doing King Dancer for you or some other good and death-defying pose. I've been really looking forward to this interview, Kat, because I've been following some of your thinking. And let me begin with something really kind of baseline, and that has to do with the impulse to write. How old were you when it struck you, and what are the psychic rewards of writing, fiction in particular?
So I am not a person who always knew that I wanted to be a writer. It's something I always enjoyed, but it was not something that I understood as a career possibility for me until I sort of fell backwards into it at the age of, I guess, maybe 25. I had been working as a publicist. That is a job that I was very, very bad at. And I was spending a lot of time on the phone with journalists. And I finally realized, you know, I don't want to be doing what I'm doing. I want to be doing what these people are doing, who I spend all day talking to. And so I pivoted into freelance copywriting, writing press kits, and then started making my way little by little, piece by piece, into doing freelance book reviews and a little bit of reporting. And from there, you know, ended up finally getting a job at MTV News, which was sort of my big entree into entertainment writing. As for the rewards of writing fiction, I think that the same thing that sort of drives me now as a culture writer is the same thing that drives me as a novelist. I'm really fascinated by the human condition and human conflict. I'm always looking for ways to understand how we treat each other as human beings, what we are to each other, what we are to ourselves. And I love to explore that through a more kind of a sociological lens when I'm writing about books or television or cultural phenomena. But I also love to do it in the confines of a world that is entirely of my own creation, with characters that are my own creation. And so I see book writing, fiction writing, and journalism as sort of two ways to approach the same big questions.
Now, the human condition, on a scale of 1 to 10, and maybe you need to stratify this, you might say, look, Generation X or baby boomers or the forthcoming alpha generation, whatever. What is the human condition on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being outstanding, 1 being dreadful?
Oh, I don't feel qualified to answer that question.
Well, you are kind of a Marshall McLuhan type. When I listen to you speak, you talk about things like sexual famine. You talk about things like the situation many young people find themselves in, where they're not. And we are going to stick with fiction writing for most of this. But I found it very interesting that, and I'm sure this bleeds into your fiction writing, young people are confused in a lot of ways. Men, I've heard you say that men are really reticent to approach women. They almost feel like they need consent before they can approach, which isn't really very doable. And women feel on guard a lot of the time. There's so much in the information stream about men abusing women, or women, in some cases, I think it's women who overreact to certain things.
because they are so clearly on guard. And the other phrase I wanted to throw at you, and then I'll let you kind of run with this, is the death of intimacy.
That is the title of an essay that I wrote, although it's not a title I chose. I thought at the time that it was a little bit overwrought. But
What would your title have been?
You know, I have not thought about that.
That one just didn't land quite cleanly with you, the death of intimacy. But go ahead.
Well, you know, I think that what all of these topics have in common is something that I'm a little bit obsessed with as a culture writer, to the point where I have to be careful not to kind of decide that it's just the thing that explains everything. You know, sometimes you can get so invested in a theory of how the world is working or what is influencing the world that you just start to see it everywhere, the proverbial hammer in search of nails. But I am very, very obsessed with the idea that our social trust, or like base level of social trust, which is sort of the glue that holds a society together, is really eroding and is being encouraged in that direction by basically all of the modes of discourse that are prevalent right now. And that does include the way that we instruct younger people in how to engage with each other. At this point, we have fomented an enormous amount of mistrust between young men and young women. Young men are told that, you know, they are like at any given moment a breath away from missing a message, misreading a cue, and then, you know, committing some kind of violation. And young women are told that they always have to be on guard because they're one breath, one missed cue away from being violated. And among other things, this is a set of circumstances under which it is basically impossible to have any fun. It's impossible to let your guard down. It's impossible to engage in physical intimacy or emotional intimacy, because you're always waiting for something bad to happen. The idea that if you like abandon yourself, if you lose focus for 1 second, something terrible will happen to you, and then you'll never be able to go back to the way things were before, is really frightening, and also really just kind of anathema to forming really true and deep connections with other people. For that to happen, you actually do have to make yourself quite vulnerable.
You know, are you, I mean, my understanding is young people, unlike my generation, rather than boy meets girl, they like each other, they go out on a date, or just go get a cup of coffee, for crying out loud. Young people now go do things in groups. And when you're in a group, it's almost intimacy avoidance, it seems. It could be anyway, because rather than pairing off and spending concentrated time and maybe even reaching over and touching the back of a young woman's hand while communicating with her, it's a group. There's some safety in that, of course. But there's also this situation where how intimate can it really get between the boy and girl who like each other? Now, there is always the opportunity to say, hey, why don't you and I just go do something sometime? But what is I don't know if you're familiar with that. I don't know if my information's outdated. But
I think it actually is a little bit, yeah.
Is that right? Tell me what you see.
Well, I mean, I am not a young person. I'm a middle-aged person. But the generation coming up, Gen Z, you know, millennials were the ones who did things in groups. That sort of became the new paradigm. But still, relationships would form there because you were still out and about with other people. Now, what is happening is a lot of interaction, most interaction even, is taking place through the intermediary of a screen. Social life has really moved online onto social media. And that has a lot of repercussions. It has a lot of consequences for the way that we engage with each other, and especially for the way that young people engage with each other and learn to engage with the world, that I think we're only just beginning to see the effects of, and we're only just beginning to reckon with.
Do you feel that when you write your fiction, when you write your novels, you're writing about the world as it is, the world as it used to be, the world as it should be, the world as it's going to be? Put a frame on that if you can.
So I think for the most part, I try to stay centered on what is. And in some cases, I mean, you must remember this is an interesting example because there is a historical timeline as well. I'm writing about things that took place in an era before I was born. So I'm writing about what was, but I've been conscious throughout this process that I am in large part imagining this. You know, I don't really know how things were before I was born. I can't know what things were like in the 1940s. I have an idea that is based on having read literature from that time, having looked at a lot of photographs from that time, watching movies from that time. But there's still this disconnect. I mean, when I think about the 1940s, I still, you know, even though I know intellectually that this is a ridiculous thing to think, it seems to me that that world was literally took place in black and white. Like, you know, color did not exist because, you know, all of the imagery from that time is largely black and white. And it's such a barrier to, but I think a useful one to realize, wow, I really, you know, I am closed off in certain ways from ever truly understanding this time. So when I'm writing, you know, I try not to be prescriptive. I'm certainly not prescriptive in my culture writing. I'm never really interested in instructing people as to what the proper solutions are. I just want to kind of kick over a rock and point at what's under there and say, what does this mean? What is that? How does it connect to everything? But I would say that both novel writing and culture writing for me is about seeking truth, if that's not too kind of
too lofty,
full of myself. Yeah, it sounds a little, you know, egomaniacal, but I'm just going to roll with it. Seeking truth. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, why not? We're all doing the same thing in one way or another. What is your biggest challenge as a fiction writer, the actual writing process? What's your biggest challenge? Where do you find things, your pinch point?
I do find I get bogged down in moments where I'm writing something that I have to kind of explain it to the audience because they don't know, but I do, and find a way to remember that that this is not boring. It feels boring to me because I know what is happening and what is going to happen, but I nevertheless have to paint a picture that allows somebody who's not inside my head to understand all of these things as well. Coincidentally, this bogged down point almost always happens about 30 to 40,000 words into a novel, which is the point at which like you're kind of past the point of no return. And that's where I also become convinced that what I'm doing is garbage and I should have not started in the first place and nobody will ever read it. That's sort of the dark night of the soul for me.
Interesting. So do you have at least a skeletal outline, or do you start with a premise and characters and let them develop the story from there?
So I tend to start with one idea, one image. You know, in most cases, because I write thrillers, it is the twist or something centered on the twist. So you must remember this is an interesting example of a book that was inspired by events in my own life. It's a book about, among other things, the death of a grandparent. And I did lose my grandmother early on in the pandemic. So part of writing this was reckoning with her loss and what it was like to lose her specifically because she was suffering from dementia. And that was, you know, very central to developing the character of Mimi in the book, the grandmother. The other thing that inspired the book was I had this image in my head that I got fixated on over the holidays in 2020. I was home for Christmas, visiting my parents in my hometown on the Hudson River. And because it was right in the midst of early COVID, everything was shut down. It felt really just so empty and deserted. And like I was sort of the last person on earth. And on top of everything else, this very thick fog had rolled in off of the river and just shrouded everything. And it was so opaque walking around that I started feeling not only like I was the last person on earth, but as though the world itself just did not exist outside the confines of wherever I was standing. surrounding, like a 20-foot radius, because, you know, I couldn't see beyond that. And so I started having a lot of kind of maybe slightly overwrought thoughts about the interaction of memory and mist and, you know, and losing yourself in something. And I developed this image in my mind of an old woman walking out onto the frozen river into the fog and disappearing. And so for me, you know, the building of a novel usually starts with something like that. And then I develop the story from there, you know, layers start to form on top of it. Who is this? What is she doing? Why is she doing it? What happened to her? What had happened to her leading up to this? Who else is in her life? And once I have, you know, a sort of a idea for a beginning, a middle, and an end, I will make a plot map, which is not quite as formal as an outline, but something just to kind of you know, help guide me on my way through. It's like a rough, sloppy write through of everything that will happen in the book, sort of scene by scene. It's a good way of identifying where chapter breaks should be, because they tend to emerge organically as I'm starting to kind of plan things out. And it'll have things like, you know, what is a character feeling at this moment? You know, what do I need to seed in here? If there's like a red herring or some kind of foreshadowing that's going to be revealed later. If there's like a great line or a piece of dialogue that I want to make sure I include, I'll add that in. So what I end up with is this kind of word vomit document, but it's something to kind of just mark where I am in the story, because when I write, I do write linearly, so just beginning to end.
Now, you say word vomit, so you overwrite on first drafts and then you start to streamline. Is that the case?
No, I actually edit as I go. So my first drafts are usually my only draft. The process then, you know, takes a little bit longer. It's a little bit more laborious, but I find that this works well for me.
Now, you mentioned Hudson River, the upstate New York, my part of the world. So I'm curious if you don't mind my asking, where in upstate New York are you?
Oh, well, I'm from Coxsackie, New York. Are you familiar?
I am not. I'm from Endicott, New York, the Binghamton area.
Okay, so
yeah, I'm not familiar. But what are you near?
Coxsackie is about 30 miles south of Albany, on the west side of the Hudson. It is directly across the river from Hudson, New York, and it's just a very, very small rural town. And so, unless you know somebody in prison, you probably have no reason ever to go there or to have heard of it, because that's sort of our main thing there. There's a bunch of correctional facilities.
Wow, big industry there. Okay, so why thrillers? There's a lot of different genres, and then there's non-genres. Just I'm writing about a topic. I'm writing about what's moving me right now. You're a genre writer. Why thrillers?
I don't know how to explain why it is that, you know, this is what sticks in my kind of mental filter. But these are the types of stories that I inevitably seize on. You know, I love horror and suspense and thrillers and, you know, to a certain extent, slashers. You know, that's the type of media I consume pretty much across the board, although I try to keep my reading a little bit more diverse just so that I don't become a kind of a one-trick pony. But yeah, you know, I just, I love to be scared and I love a puzzle. And I think those two things in combination make thrillers a very natural home for me.
What really scares you, though? Because there's the kind of, I think about this more in movies, because it seems like more people talk about movies these days than books. And sometimes it's only the psychological that scares people. If it's, you know, pretty much anything else doesn't really scare them all that much. What scares you?
Well, I mean, I'm very big believer in the power of the thing that you don't see to frighten you. You know, the dark room where there might be a shape that's a little bit darker than the rest, but you can't be sure unless you turn on the light. But, you know, do you want to risk fumbling for that switch, or do you want to just turn your back and run? So that to me is just sort of the idea. And also the type of thing when I encounter it in a movie or in a book that I find most frightening, but, you know, in an exciting way, because, you know, the great thing about stories like this is that they allow you to be scared, but in a kind of a safe way.
What gives you anxiety in life?
Oh, that's a personal question. I'm going to give you a really weird answer. This is a little esoteric, but it's something that I think about all the time. I am anxious about all of the ephemera, the digital ephemera that I am collecting now as a person who is alive, and what is going to happen to it when I die. Mm-hmm. I think that there's something really spooky and kind of sad about the fact that we now, you know, wink out of existence and leave behind this invisible life, you know, just decades of photographs that live online, you know, internet searches, correspondence, whereas, you know, somebody my grandmother's age left behind like a shoebox full of letters and albums full of physical photographs. There's something about the shift into virtual space that I think is really terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost a form of life after death. It continues to exist unless you actually appoint somebody to take it all down, if that's even possible. And some of the time it's not even possible. Can I talk to you about your grandmother for a minute? I understand if you want to just skip on this because it might be emotional, but your grandmother had dementia. She died of COVID. Was it a blessing, her passing, in that you've got a believe in a spiritual dimension or a life force, or was it a tragedy?
Well, she was 105. So,
wow. You're going to live a long life, Kat.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, so it was, of course, sad to lose her, but obviously not unexpected. You know, the thing that was tragic about it was the circumstances under which it happened, you know, because not only did she have to die alone, surrounded by strangers, because we were not allowed to visit her, we also were not allowed to gather to grieve. You know, there was no funeral, there was no memorial. I, you know, was not able to go back home and, you know, give my mom a hug. There was the sense at this time, it was, I think, April of 2020, that like the virus was everywhere. It was in the air, it was on your clothes. You know, if you touched somebody, you would kill them. It was really just a scary and isolating moment. And as a result, just, I think, one of the worst times to have to lose somebody, even somebody who was as old as my grandmother was.
I understand. It was so much scarier in the beginning. I mean, over time we realized, okay, it's not as deadly as we thought, although it killed an awful lot of people. But in the beginning it was quite scary. Tell us about your new novel. You've got now, this is number 5, is that correct?
That's right.
And your title is, I mixed
up. You
must
remember this.
You must remember this. Okay, that's what I thought. Tell us about it. Give us a little bit of an exploration of it. What do people need to know about it?
Okay, so it is Christmas Eve, December 2014, and a fractured family has gathered at their estate on the coast of Maine for what they believe is going to be their matriarch's last Christmas. Her name is Miriam Caravasios. She has dementia. She is slowly slipping away. Her memory is going. The family is sort of at each other's throats. When Miriam dies, she's going to leave behind a $20 million fortune. And so tensions are, of course, high amongst the three siblings, her children, who are there to see her out, but also maybe to kind of stake a claim to what she'll leave behind. On Christmas Eve, Miriam slips out of the house in the middle of the night. She walks onto the frozen cove and she falls through the ice and dies. And it is a terrible accident, or was it?
Now you have to account for everybody's whereabouts.
Yes. So, you know, this is the very first thing that happens in the book. You know, you know from the get-go that she dies, that she will die. And then From there, we have two timelines. One of them follows Miriam and her granddaughter Delphine in the days before her death, through her death, and then in the weeks that follow, as Delphine starts to become suspicious that maybe it wasn't an accident, that maybe there was something not quite right going on there. And also, at the same time, you'll travel back in time to a period between 1939 and 1960, when Miriam was a young woman, part of initially a wealthy community of summers at Bar Harbor, who fell in love with a local fisherman, ended up getting married and settling down there in her parents' grand mansion, which is this ramshackle crumbling estate called the Whispers. So Miriam's story of falling in love with her husband Theo, getting married, and then things maybe falling apart in certain ways. Theo is killed in a boating accident just about 15 years after they got married. Her story runs very much parallel to Delphine's. There are echoes back and forth between past and present, and they reveal things about both women's lives.
Now, because she had dementia, that's almost a bit of an alibi, isn't it? Because she may wander off like a lot of people with dementia do, not really knowing where she's going or what kind of danger she's putting herself in. So that's a potential alibi there, I would imagine, if there was somebody nefarious who played a hand in that. Did your grandmother play a role in this? Because it sounds like maybe there was a little bit of influence there, maybe an ode to your grandmother. Maybe you wanted to spend more time with your grandmother in this way, or is this completely separate?
No, it absolutely is linked. So my grandmother did have dementia. She and I were not particularly close, but it actually did not matter because toward the end of her life, she didn't really remember anything from the past 30 years or so. And so the only way to really have a relationship with a person who's in that kind of mental place where, you know, they don't remember who you are, they won't remember having seen you when you visit, you start fresh every single time. So the only way to do it is to just meet them where they are. And the interesting thing was that for my grandmother, it wasn't just where she was, but when she was. She was like an internal time traveler. And she had, as much as she could not remember, things from the recent past, she had the most vivid memories of things that had happened in her youth, long before I was born or before my mother was born. And I loved catching these glimpses of the woman that she had been. One of my favorite stories that she would tell was about how in 1932, she applied to be a coat check girl at the Roseland Ballroom in Chicago. And she was turned down because she was not pretty enough. They told her this right to her face. It was a very different time. And she was as salty about this as if it had happened like last month.
Wow. Wow. So she remembered it and she would give voice to it and she used the salty language through the whole thing.
Yes.
Wow. Why don't we have you read an excerpt from the book? And are you going to start from the beginning or are you going to go to the interior of the book? Set it up for us.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the part. This is from Delphine's perspective when they discover Miriam's body. So I'm going to start.
So the relationship again, Delphine, her relationship.
Delphine is Miriam's granddaughter.
Got it.
She's a sort of a lost soul. She has come back to the Whispers, to ostensibly be with her mom and help take care of her grandmother. But she had good reasons for needing to leave her situation in New York. Things were not going well for her. Okay. So this is Christmas morning. Mm-hmm. Someone was pounding on my door. The sound matched the pounding in my head. Delphine? My mother's voice. I struggled to peel my eyes open, reached for my phone, but the screen stayed dark, dead, no charge. I turned my head to look out the window and saw fog, nothing but fog, as if the house had been picked up overnight and dropped into some other dimension, a deep gray void with no end. I rubbed my eyes and shivered. The room was very, very cold. What? I croaked. The door cracked open. Are you sick? I've been knocking and knocking, Mom said and heaved a sigh. Your grandmother is playing hide and seek again. You haven't seen her, have you? She isn't in her room. But nobody was worried. Not then, not really. After all, we thought we knew this game by now, and not just that, we thought we'd figured out that the winning move was not to play. Mimi would turn up when she got tired of hiding. All we had to do was wait. She does this because it gets a rise out of us, Diana was saying as I came into the kitchen. She always did love to make a stir. Well, I'm not worried. I refuse to worry. It's what she wants, for us all to lose our minds and run around like chickens with our heads cut off. I say let's just wait. She'll come out when she gets hungry. You make her sound like a lost cat, my mom said, and Richard guffawed. Now, why didn't I think of that before, he said. When she comes back, can we put a bell on her? Everyone laughed. Why not? It was funny. It took an hour for it to stop being funny. We did start looking then, just like we'd done before, but we were annoyed, not scared, and the search had none of the urgency of the day before last. We dutifully fanned out up the stairs, down the halls, in and out of the empty rooms, all the while expecting that we'd probably come back to the kitchen and find her waiting for us, eating the last of the cookies and smirking. The sky darkened and the snow began to fall, huge fat flakes that accumulated quickly on the windowsills, the pathways, the bare branches of the trees. Diana abandoned the search in order to start making the turkey, still certain that Mimi would turn up by the time we sat down to eat it. But she stayed missing and the snow kept falling, and finally my mother glanced out the window at the foggy bay, at the swirling sky, and said, I'm just going to check outside, just in case. I'll come with you, I said, but by the time I had found my boots and coat, she was already gone, so I followed her footprints. Through the fresh fallen snow, from the front door to the side to the back, where they crossed the veranda and went down the stairs to the garden. The footprints turned right at the long stone wall, then veered away through the trees to the pine path. I heard Adam's voice behind me then. He called my name and I looked back to see him standing on the veranda waving. I waved back, but I didn't wait. I kept going. I think maybe even then I knew something was wrong. And I think I knew because she did, my mother. Her footprints danced away ahead of me, and I could see from the length and shape of her stride that she had started to hurry. The tracks disappeared down the pine path into the darkness of the trees. I chased them, faster, my breath coming in puffs, my heart starting to race. Matching my strides to hers, slowing down only when I came to the fallen tree in the middle of the path, but I was alone and climbed over it easily, the trunk cold and slimy beneath my hands, and in the back of my head I heard Mimi's voice saying, "The path goes on, we just can't get there," and realized she was wrong. We could have gotten here any time. She could have gotten here any time, because the tree wasn't really that big after all. Certainly not big enough to stop a spry and determined old woman from crossing over, from going out to the place where the sea lavender grows, where she used to walk so often as a girl, a young woman, a wife. And that was when I heard it. A howl, wild and keening. It was a terrible sound. The sound of an animal trapped and dying, and every hair on the back of my neck stood on end as I listened between the trees, barely breathing, waiting. The howl ended, there was silence, and then it began again. I ran toward the noise down the shadowed path to the place where the woods ended and the rocky coastline began, letting go of my coat so that it flapped open, but I no longer felt the chill. I ran even though that voice inside me, that cold and logical voice, was suddenly awake again and telling me no. Don't turn around, because whatever was making that sound was something I didn't want to see. I ran, the trees passing in a blur beside me, until suddenly they fell away and I was standing in the cove, and the howl had started again, and the howling animal wasn't an animal at all, but my mother. She was on her knees at the edge of the frozen reach, her hands bare, pounding her fists at the ice and snow that was already turning red with her blood. Her mouth was open and she was screaming, and the scream was living anguish wrapped around a single word, no. No, she screamed, no, 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 as her fists hit the ice and her knuckles split open and the ice didn't crack at all. Not a crack, not a flaw. It was clear, so beautifully clear, that frozen water smeared with blood. He caught up to me then, Adam. He must have been coming after me, tracking my steps as I had tracked my mother's, running at the sound of her terrible cry. He saw me and he saw what was in front of me and he gathered me up in his arms and said, don't look, don't look. But I had already looked. I had already seen. I would never stop seeing it. My mother on her knees howling, her knuckles bruised and bleeding. The snow falling fast now. The ice and what lay beneath it. Mimi's eyes were open, open wide in her pale frozen face. open wide below the frozen surface of the sea that drowned her and then pushed her back to shore, gazing into the flat gray sky forever and seeing nothing at all.
Wow, that is haunting. I love
Thank
how you.
You
take the animal. It sounded like an animal, maybe trapped and caught in a trap, and it turned out to be the mother. Wow. Where does this novel rank in your body of work in terms of virtuosity? Do you feel that this is your best writing? Are you continuing to improve as a writer? And if you are, is it anything conscious you're doing, or is it just a matter of I continue to write, I've been writing for years, and practice makes you better?
It's an interesting question. I'm a terrible judge of my own writing. I never really know how it's going when I'm in the thick of it. And even now, other people tell me that they see me developing as a writer, and I'm like, that's great, but I don't necessarily see it. What I do think is improving for me as I continue to, put words on the page and continue especially to write fiction is I've become better at pacing and plotting, understanding how to fit the pieces of a story together. And I've also become less precious about trying to make everything perfect. And this has been something that I had to kind of train myself to do as a journalist, because when you have like a daily or a weekly deadline, you really can't take your time with it. You just have to, you have to write what you do, write what you can. And if it's not perfect, it has to be just good enough. You have to let it go.
You know, I remember Peggy Noonan, the speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, talking about when she was in radio, and she said the deadlines came fast, and she said you really learned that you were not going to write your best stuff, and sometimes you were actually going to write badly because you're under such deadline pressure and you just needed to turn out the copy. And she thought that was really good training, because she didn't agonize over it after a while. She just took it in stride. Obviously, with a novel, you have whatever time is necessary, unless you're under a contractual deadline or what have you. Describe your writing regimen. Are you a daily writer? Do you only write when you're working on a book? Do you take several months off once you've completed a book?
Oh gosh, that sounds so luxurious. I would love to do that. No, I am a say yes to too many things person, and end up overextending myself basically as a matter of course. So I do write every day, because I always have something going. If not a novel, then an essay that I have due. I do have a weekly column at this point at Unheard. So, I always have to be either working on that or thinking ahead to the next one. And my writing regimen is essentially, if I'm home, I am working. This was one of the reasons that I continued to teach yoga, even though I don't really need the money at this point anymore, because it is something that gets me out of the house and gets me to actually move my body. Otherwise, I would just kind of sink into the couch cushions.
I understand. So you write for magazines, including Reason, which is a libertarian magazine, really pushes for the privatization of just about everything rather than having government handle it. Entertainment Weekly, very well-read magazine, but also the New York Times. And you're a regular contributor to New York Magazine as well, is that correct? Or
I used to write for Vulture pretty regularly. I haven't in quite a while. As I've gotten more into the kind of culture and political space, I've done less entertainment writing, which is, a shame and something that I would like to remedy at some point.
So what are your pre-writing rituals? Do you have any when you're going to sit down to write some fiction? It's your day to write. You set aside 2, 3, 4 hours. Do you do anything ritualistic, or do you have any idiosyncrasies that are kind of the gateway to actually sitting down and getting going?
No, that's a very boring answer, but no, I just I sit down, I open my laptop, and I get to work.
So what's
I have
a
things
reason?
That I do if I hit like a block, if the words are, not coming like they should, then I, you know, there are some certain things that I'll try, including the Pomodoro method, which is where you you set a timer for 25 minutes and force yourself to write as much as you can. You're sort of racing against yourself to just like get something onto the page. And if that doesn't work, then I have a beer as long as it's afternoon.
So did you call it the Pomodoro method?
Yeah, that's what it's called. And I don't know why. I don't know what it has to do with tomatoes, but something.
So when you you do the 25 minutes, do you then take a break and then reset for 25 more?
Yep, 25 minutes on, 5 minutes off, repeat.
Got it. So what's your, if you were to average it out, you produce a novel every how many months or years?
It's not quite regular yet. So you must remember this. I wrote in about 6 months. I got the idea December 2020, and the manuscript was due December 2021, and I didn't start really writing in earnest until May. Before that, I spent probably a year and a half writing No One Will Miss Her, which was my first adult novel. But that was an idea that I had been cooking on kind of in the back of my head for probably 4 years before I started writing. So, you know, I can write very quickly, but what I'm discovering is that it's not what I prefer.
You were writing some YA or young adult fiction prior to that, is that right?
Yes, I wrote two YA novels. The first one was came out in 2012, so it's been exactly 10 years.
So, you know, people used to say that Elmore Leonard writes dialogue like he invented it. He was really known for his dialogue. What aspect of your writing game do you consider your greatest strength?
Oh, I think sense of place is something that I'm good at. I love to kind of linger in the details of, you know, how things look, the quality of the air, the quality of the light, and how things smell, which I think is so important. People are always saying, you know, how do you make a really vivid setting? And I always tell them to focus on how things smell. It's the one thing that I think writers frequently overlook.
Yeah. You know, they talk about all the senses, engaging all the senses. I think that that's one of those things that people don't keep in mind very often. But yeah. And also just the olfactory is so powerful when you smell something that you smelled 20 or 30 years ago, and it takes you right back to that place. It's the familiarity is basically instantaneous. So yeah, definitely something that gets overlooked a lot. Give us a book recommendation or two.
Oh gosh.
From other authors. Are there a couple of books that you really value that that meant something special to you?
I will say The World According to Garp by John Irving, which I read in high school, and that book was a revelation to me about what a novel could be. Until then, you know, I had been reading, like, you know, the classics to a certain extent, and I was into Stephen King, and I was into, like, you know, the teen fiction of the time. This was the 90s, so I was real big on, like, Lois Lowry, Lois Duncan, Lorelei McDaniel, who wrote these books about teenagers with cancer. They were just, like, so trashy, but so great. And when I read The World According to Garp, I was like, this is, like, nothing I've ever experienced. I just had no idea that a book could be as vivid and as cheeky and as, you know, real, even though it was entirely made up. The thing that I remember is that for the longest time, I thought that the activist group in that book, the Ellen Jamesians, who I don't know if you've read that or if you remember who they are.
Oh,
they
yeah. Were, oh, yeah.
The feminists who cut off their own tongues, you know, as a form of protest. I thought they were real. I should apologize to everybody I told about them as though they were a real thing. But that's book number one. And then book number two, I'm going to have to say, The Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah, I've read them both. And I have to tell you that I'm so glad you brought up The World According to Garp, because that was a turning point for me as well. I was, you know, in my early 20s, I was considered myself a good writer, but I thought, yeah, I'm never going to be good enough to write novels. And then I read that. I even did a little podcast about it. And it was a little, it was almost as though, how do I say this without make casting aspersions on John Irving? Because I have great respect for John Irving. It's a great book, but it was the one that had a tone and a story that made me think, I can do this. I can do it. Not because it's easy, but because it just opened the door in some way. And very much like what you're talking about, where it's like, wow, look what's possible with a novel. It doesn't have to be. I think a lot of the novels I had read prior to that were, oh, maybe a little bit turgid, maybe overwritten, maybe tried to be too intellectual or what have you. I don't know. But The World According to Garp is definitely, you know, occupies a special place in my life as well. What about an influential book, whether it be fiction or nonfiction? Was there, maybe we go to a nonfiction book, but there's something you read that had a big influence on your life?
On my life.
Or thinking, well, that would be your life. As Philip Roth, as we are our memories. We're nothing without our memories.
Well, you know, what's funny is that what I'm actually seizing on is The Shining, which certainly did have a big influence on my life in that it made me afraid of my bathroom for probably 10 years. In my defense, I didn't read it recently. My mom gave it to me to read. I was 11, and I was a big reader as a kid, and I was casting about for something new. I had like kind of consumed all of the age-appropriate fiction in the house, and my mom knew I liked ghost stories. I don't think she had read The Shining. I think she just had it, and she grabbed it off the shelf and handed it to me and said, here, I hear this is scary. You'll like it. And I did. But oh my God.
Had an afterlife. You collaborated with the late Stan Lee, the famous comic book writer and producer. How did that come about?
So that was an amazing opportunity that I managed to get through my agent, who was involved in the development of that project. It was Stan and then two guys, Luke Lieberman and Ryan Silbert. They were working to develop a new superhero universe with an eye toward doing it both for the digital age and also doing it for audio exclusively, although it ended up ultimately also being a print book. But this was an Audible exclusive project, so the idea was to play in the kind of, you know, radio drama, like audio fiction space. And my agent said, I want you to put yourself up for this, you know, I want you to provide some writing samples and so on. So it was me and then I think maybe four or five guys, all of whom had experience in either comic book writing, science fiction writing, franchise, tie-in fiction, like the Star Wars books, and then me. And fortunately, they decided that between Luke and Ryan and Stan, there was enough nerdy representation and also enough testosterone on the project. And they wanted somebody who brought something a little different to the table. And that was me.
So check me on this. You co-authored that with Stan Lee and some other parties. And it's a book titled A Trick of Light.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Okay. Wanted our listeners to get that title. You're also a podcaster. You co-host a podcast titled Feminine Chaos. What's the objective of that podcast?
That's another thing that just kind of came about organically. My friend Phoebe Maltz-Bovey and I were talking publicly on Twitter about kind of culture, war, and feminist topics. And people kept saying, we want you guys to do this in a different format. We want you to do a podcast. So we started doing a podcast. And 4 years later, here we are.
I love the name. What's the anything behind the name?
No, it's there is this like Jungian or Jungian, I never know how to pronounce that. Archetype of the, it's like the idea of like the masculine order and then the chaotic feminine. But mostly I just liked the way these two things sounded together, feminine chaos. It's got a good mouthfeel to it.
Yeah, it does. So true or false, social media has put a major dent in book reading.
Probably true.
Because they say people read and write more today than ever, but there are so many channels and it's done very short form most of the time. And a lot of time, of course, it's people just attacking one another based on somebody else's post. What is the most, I think I asked you this in different form, but you might have a different answer for it or reinforce what you said earlier. What's the most rewarding part of the writing process for you?
I mean, just the act of sitting down and working through something, whether it's, you know, building a scene in prose or solving a problem, like a plot problem that has been bothering me, or even just outlining an essay, you know, kind of taking these ideas out of my head and starting to like lay them out in order. It's very soothing to me. I think that it's good for my mental health on top of everything else.
What is the biggest writing lesson you've learned? There must be a trick or some kind of maybe mental framework that you adopted along the way that really made a difference.
The biggest lesson that I've learned, it's never as bad as you think it is.
What's the best piece of career advice you've received? It might not even be the writing process itself, but getting published and getting your novel sold. What would you say?
Career advice. Actually, oh, this is, you know, it's more like life advice that also applies to one's career. My mom would always say this. I mean, she still does. It's don't let the turkeys get you down.
The turkeys?
The turkeys, which is, you know, to say don't trouble yourself with the opinions of people whose good opinion is not worth having.
Got it. Got it. Turkey as in that. Yeah, it turned out to be a real turkey or.
Yeah. That's such, I want to bring that word back. It's such an underrated, you know, like nobody says that anymore.
No, it's rare. But I've lived long enough that I've heard it many times, but they don't really use it very often anymore. So that's why I hesitated just a little bit. Tell us something people would be surprised to know about you.
Gosh, surprised. I'm actually a very friendly, sunny person in real life, despite the content of my novels.
What's your idea of a perfect writing day?
Ooh, that would be. Well, for one thing, it would take place somewhere other than in my house. I would like to be in the proverbial like log cabin out in the woods somewhere. I would like to wake up, have coffee, do some writing, go out for a walk in the woods, come back and find that somebody had left a basket of food on the porch so that I don't have to cook anything for myself. And then I would eat lunch and then I would get back to writing. And then, at the end of the day, I would go for another walk and that would be it. That would be a perfect writing day.
So speaking of food, let's say you're organizing a dinner party, which three literary figures, dead or alive, do you invite?
Oh gosh. Okay. Well, let's see, like, supposing that I want the dinner party to devolve into chaos, I think I would like to invite Dorothy Parker, Jordan Peterson, and he's not really a literary figure, but he's a culture figure. That counts, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Anybody you want.
Yeah. Dorothy Parker, Jordan Peterson, and one more literary figure. Dostoevsky.
Oh, wow. Okay. Do you have anything that you consider your greatest extravagance as a writer?
Like in terms of things that I use to write?
that, or that you know that maybe in your writing you do certain things that a writing coach would say you really shouldn't do that, but it's kind of like, yeah, look, that's an extravagance that I put in my writing and it works for me, it pleases me.
Oh, that's a good one. I'm going to give myself a complex by thinking too hard about this, but I do love to luxuriate in the descriptions of things, sometimes past the point of usefulness.
I'm sorry, say it again.
I said I like to luxuriate in the descriptions of things, sometimes past the point of usefulness.
Got
where
it.
I know the reader is over there like, all right, we get it, you know? Like, it was cold, it was gray, move on.
Tom Wolfe used to do that to me with all his descriptions of landscapes and all. I love his writing, but there are times when he spent a little too much time with the landscape and all. But he was very architectural and all that as well. So do you listen to music or any other sound while you're writing?
I cannot write to music with lyrics. So I do have a playlist called Depressing Classical Music that I sometimes will put on in the background when I'm writing. But for the most part, I just prefer silence.
So what are you streaming or watching on Netflix these days or other premium channels?
So my husband and I have just gotten into the whole Yellowstone universe. Mm-hmm. We resisted for a long time, and I haven't actually watched the main show, but the historical spinoffs, the 1883 and now the 1923, they're really fun. They're kind of like soap operas, but also like Old West dramas. So that's kind of a blast. The other thing that I really love, which I'm excited that it's coming back, is Severance, which mm-hmm. is one of the most high concept, darkly funny things I have ever seen on television. It's so smart and so weird.
Have you seen Fleischman Is in Trouble?
No, I haven't read it either. This is a huge hole in my knowledge. I think that like my place is a figure in the millennial literary landscape, especially as something of a feminist, gets revoked for not having read that book yet. So don't tell anybody.
Well, I guess maybe it's because I'm a guy, but it didn't strike me particularly as a feminist novel. But I have to say, I watched the first few episodes, then I realized, oh, this is based on a novel. And Taffy Rodesser Ackner is very involved in the show. I think she wrote all the scripts. It adheres very closely to the book. You hear a lot of the dialogue and all that straight from the book. So I got the book. It's got a lot of sexual language in it, a lot of sexual mm-hmm. language. And, you know, my feeling is that if Philip Roth's name had been on it, or Norman Mailer was the byline, or John Updike, the feminists would have savaged the book. They would have said it was gratuitous sex. It was misogynistic. Excuse me. And, but instead she was celebrated, and I love the book. I love it. And I'm looking forward to her next one. But there is this kind of double standard. Most double standards work against women and in favor of men. There are some though that work in favor of women. I just could not see a man writing that book and not being attacked. But
yeah, probably not. But you know, the pendulum will swing back probably, or maybe it will swing into the center and stay there.
Yeah, well, yeah, we'll see. I highly recommend the book, and the series is great too. But and I know that she's just about she's close on releasing her second novel. What social media sites do you find of value? Social media accounts or sites that you find of value?
So I'm very on Twitter, which is sort of required if you are a media person. You know, especially writing like cultural or politics stuff. It's sort of a double-edged sword because I can definitely lose hours on there, you know, like responding to people whose critiques I should just like let slide off my back. But I do find Twitter valuable professionally, personally not so much, but I have gotten an enormous amount of work from people that I met on that website. So I can't really throw too much shade at it. Apart from that, I'm not a huge social media person. I'm active on Instagram because I kind of feel like I have to be. There's a pretty big community of people who read in the genre that I write on there. But you know, my feelings about social media is mainly that it's a time suck.
Yeah, It certainly can be. Are you on TikTok at all?
No, I'm terrified of TikTok. I won't do it.
If you could go back in time, Kat, and what would you tell a 21-year-old Kat Rosenfield?
Oh, gosh. I would tell her, you are not as fat as you think you are.
Were you, did you feel that you had extra pounds back in the day?
Oh, I mean, I, you know, I'm 40 now, so I grew up right in the thick of the like heroin chic aesthetic. Mm. And that gave me a relatively skewed idea of how an adult woman's body should look. So I have actually never in my life been overweight or carried extra weight, but nevertheless, I felt like I was grotesque as a teenager and a young adult.
Sure, that was the era of the social x-rays, as Tom Wolf called them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I have just a few more questions for you, and you're pretty good at interpreting things, and I'm not sure that most people would handle this one well, but my question is, do you write with self-love or self-loathing, or is it both?
Oh, gosh.
In other words, how you feel when you're writing.
I don't think about myself at all when I'm writing. I think about the story. So maybe that's self-indulgence.
Well, you get lost in the writing then,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is ideal, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have made choices as a writer that served my story, or that served my, you know, if I'm writing an essay, that served my argument or served to, you know, to point out something that I think is important to point out that I knew were going to be unpopular. And I don't know if that is a form of self-loathing, or if it's a form of self-love, you know, to say, well, but, you know, but this is so important that it needs to be said anyway, or I don't care how people feel about this. So yeah, I guess, you know, self-indulgence is probably the best word for it.
Mm-hmm. What will growing old be like for you?
I mean, I've, so far, I have only enjoyed getting older. I know that there's research suggesting that experience of life stops around age 50. We'll see what happens. But I anticipate that, you know, getting old will be not all that different from my life now, you know, within, I guess, reasonable limits. I'm active now in anticipation of probably being pretty long lived. You know, obviously I had a grandmother who passed at 105. Everybody else in my family lives into their 90s. So I'm trying to, you know, to stay fit and stay mobile and in anticipation of needing to still be mobile for a long time. And I hope that my brain remains sharp enough that I can continue to write, you know, well into my dotage. Once that's done, if it's ever done, you know, I hope that I can have a quiet and not too lonely final chapter.
Which leads, that's a nice segue to my final question, which is, how do you want to be remembered?
I'm thinking about my mother, who wants on her tombstone, she wants it to say, she did not suffer fools gladly, which I think is so badass, but you know, I don't think that I'm quite there. I would like to be remembered for being a thoughtful person and a generous one.
Very good, very good. And we wish you luck with that. And congratulations on the new novel, Kat, and I wish you much success with that. And thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.